It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll kick off our Literacy in Wisconsin series. All week, we'll learn about efforts to help improve literacy around the state.
First, Walgreens announced a new plan to combat prescription drug abuse. They're installing safe medication disposal kiosks in their drugstores in 39 states and Washington, D.C. Walgreens is also making the life-saving opioid antidote naloxone, also known as Narcan, available without a prescription in 35 states, including Wisconsin.
Wisconsin is in the midst of what some are calling a heroin epidemic. The number of heroin cases processed by the state crime lab has steadily increased in almost every Wisconsin county over the last 3 years. According to the Wisconsin Department of Justice, the number of heroin-related deaths rose about 50% last year to 199, and to put that number in context, Wisconsin averaged only 29 heroin-related deaths from 2000 to 2007.
Dr. Chris Eberlein is with us now to talk about Narcan and what this move could do to help prevent overdose deaths in Wisconsin. He's an emergency physician at Gunderson Health System and medical director for Tri-State Ambulance. He's also the medical advisor for Region 4 for the Wisconsin Healthcare Coalition. Dr. Eberlein, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So what do we know about why Walgreens decided to make this move to offer Narcan in stores without a prescription?
Well, I think it started with the HOPE legislation that was passed this year. That was a big part of it. And I think they've seen that this has been a real problem. And Narcan has been shown to save lives when used even at home like this. You know, obviously we've been using it with our EMS systems and first responders, and we've had good results. And this is just the next step.
If you could brush us up a little, what is Narcan and how does it work?
Narcan is a opiate antagonist, and so what it does when the opiate's on the receptor is causing the respiratory depression and the altered mental status that will actually knock the opiate off the receptors in the brain, and then it can function normal again.
Now, as I understand it, there are different forms of Narcan, different ways that it can be delivered into the body. What are they, and is there a preferred method?
Yeah, you can do it one of three ways. The traditional way has been an IV route, and that's how it's given in the hospital. And recently, now that it's been pushed on to first responders, they've realized it can be given intranasally as a mist, which is, in my view, the preferred route for the pre-hospital setting for a number of reasons. One, it's as effective as the IV dose. It takes effect almost immediately because it crosses the blood-brain barrier very rapidly. And the second reason is safety. There's no needle involved then. So you don't have to worry about another needle on scene. Inadvertent needle pokes from healthcare at a scene like that is high risk.
Right now, what kinds of channels does someone have to go to get a prescription or to get access to Narcan?
Right now, you'd actually have to have your regular family physician write your prescription, take you to the pharmacist. What this bill is working on doing is, and what Walgreens would like to do, it's basically a standing order. So they have a medical director who's written a standing prescription, and you can go to the pharmacist, and you can ask for that for Narcan, pay for it, and they'll give you a little bit of hopefully instruction on it, and off you go, and you don't have to have an individual prescription.
So the standing order from the physician would be to the drugstore, to Walgreens in general, or to an individual person?
It would be to the store in general.
And would there be any kinds of records kept about who was buying the Narcan?
No, and that's one of the components that they were trying to get across at the legislators, because the thought would be that if you had a trail, people would be less likely to use it.
Well, we're talking right now with Dr. Eberlein. He is an emergency physician at Gunderson Health System, talking now about the news that Wisconsin Walgreens and a lot of other states as well will provide the life-saving opioid antidote Narcan without a prescription. How significant is this in the fight to curb the deaths that can occur from heroin overdose in Wisconsin and elsewhere?
I think it's a really big deal. This is fortunate we have a great antidote for opiate overdose, and it is Narcan. It works remarkably well, very, very low side effects. Really, the only contraindication is a true allergy to it, and you rarely see that. So you actually have a tool that's very effective. Intranasally, it can be given very easily and safely by any bystander. So I think this is a key component to preventing overdose deaths. Is it going to fix our heroin epidemic? No, but it will keep people alive.
Is there any concern that this could boomerang and the amount of people using heroin could increase because now the risk threshold has been lowered a bit?
Yeah, I think that's always on the surface a concern, but I don't think that's going to play out. There has been some studies, and I was actually looking this afternoon as far back as 2007, 2006. They were studying this in other areas of the world even. It wasn't playing out to be the case. But yet it was saving lives. So I think that you may get some people that push the envelope to how much they can use, and I think that is a legitimate concern. However, these people are using a drug that they often don't know what they're getting anyway, so they can get a drug that could be multitude stronger than what they thought, and so their risk of overdose is high regardless, and I think having something available that is so effective is really key.
Is there any pushback on this for Walgreens, or is this something that's generally accepted to be a good and useful thing?
I think 5 years ago there would have been pushback, but I think people are seeing the epidemic that we have with opiate overdoses in our country and realizing that something else has to be done. And knowing how effective this has been in the first responders, and now this is just the next step to making it more available, and I have no doubt this will save lives.
It's rumored so far, I guess we don't have a final figure here, but that the cost of Narcan at Walgreens will be $165. I don't know how many doses that is, but that's a steep price tag. Does that cut down on accessibility for people who may need it?
I think if that is indeed how high they're going to sell it for, which I've also heard that number, yeah, I think it is going to be a real barrier for a lot of people. I think in general, the market for this is probably family members buying it for their loved one who they know is using to hopefully make them safer. But I still think that at $165, I think you will see an impact on the number of people that can't get it because of the cost.
Now, looking at just one other aspect of this new plan by Walgreens, another way Walgreens is trying to cut down on heroin abuse is by providing safe medication disposal kiosks. How would that work, and how would that cut down on heroin use abuse in Wisconsin?
I think that is probably one of the more key components of this, of what they're doing. We've been pushing for drug take-backs, but they were twice a year. And now, at least in our community, we've got several drop boxes, and they've collected thousands of pounds of medication. It's really quite remarkable. The key to this is preventing someone to start using heroin. And we know that prescription drug abuse is a true gateway into heroin use. And some people have cited 90% of heroin abusers have started with prescription drug abuse. So if we can get those drugs off the streets, out of the medicine cabinets where they're not being used, and dispose of properly, we should have a significant impact on the number of people that start.
It's an interesting initiative because it's coming, it sounds like, from Walgreens, the company itself. Is there anything else that other drugstores or other outside actors could do to help with the heroin epidemic?
Yeah, I think this is a model that could be taken by any pharmacy. I'm glad to see Walgreens doing it. You know, I know, for instance, the hospital I work at Gunderson Health is working on doing the same thing. They're just starting the process as well. Walgreens here doesn't have it yet. I'm hoping it's soon, but I haven't been given a date for it either.
Dr. Eberlein, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was Dr. Chris Eberlein, emergency physician at Gunderson Health System. He joined us to talk about the news that Wisconsin Walgreens and Walgreens elsewhere will also provide the life-saving opioid antidote Narcan without a prescription.
Maria Huerta moved to Milwaukee from Mexico after marrying her husband. She knew no English when she arrived, but eagerly jumped into classes. She later got a job at the public library where she helped Spanish speakers like herself navigate a new world.
Hey, my name is Maria Huerta, and I'm from Guadalajara, Mexico. I have been living here for 12 years. I came here because I get married. My husband, he's living here for more than 30 years, and I met him in Guadalajara, and he said, you want to be my fiancé? You want to get married with me? You know, and I'm here. I think learn another language is really hard. Other cultures is totally different, especially Mexico and United States is different. But I've been fighting all the time. That's, I eat English, I have lunch for English, I dream English, so I'm fighting all the time with this language, and I'm trying. I was working at Journey House since 2012, and I was working as receptionist, and Gloria told me, hey, somebody gonna need a position at the library. Would you like to be helper or something? And I said, because they need, they have a lot of Spanish population. And I said, yes, why not? And I started just working, like helping people. But the library right now, it's really nice. They have a lot of Spanish speakers. And I can see the people when they are trying to get a library card or get information, their faces look like scary, like, you know, oh, who's going to speak Spanish? Who's going to help me? But because it happened to me before, that's why. And I was looking like a familiar, something like my country. And I love the library. I love it. I have a notebook with a lot of questions, and you know what? I'm repeating the letters all the time, like 5 times. That's what I do to learn new words. I'm trying to learn 2 or 3 words every day. I always have questions, you know. My teachers, I think when they see me coming and say, oh, Maria is coming, she want to ask more questions, because I do. I have a daughter and a son, and both speak English and in Spanish very well. And I'm talking with my daughter. My daughter, she's 11 right now. And I said, Monse, did I say this wrong? Or, Mom, it's okay. You can do, you know, pronunciation is really different. And my husband, he speaks Spanish. He said, I don't like English. I have to do it, but he doesn't like. He loves to fix in cars, but he doesn't know the names or the specific parts. And he's asked me, you know what? I'm translating him right now. So it's kind of hard because everybody speaks Spanish at home. So I had to find and look. I had to find friends who just speak only English, because I'm trying to say, you have to speak English, only English, only English. But yeah, that's the life. It's hard, but it's not impossible. It's not impossible. I think if you want to do something, just fight and fight. And some people, they take like less than me, but I'm not gonna stop. I'm gonna continue, and I'm gonna do for me. I don't want to say this, but I'm really proud of me, because you know what, I've been working a lot.
Maria Huerta is a Mexican immigrant who works at the Milwaukee Public Library. She shared her story as part of this week's look at literacy in Wisconsin.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org.
Joining us now to talk about literacy efforts in our state is Michelle Erickson, Executive Director at Wisconsin Literacy. Michelle, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So how does literacy affect the general population when some people in the community don't know how to read?
Well, literacy is just so important because it's more akin to a basic human right than it is to just a skill set that helps you decode words, which is how a lot of people might think about the ability to read and write at first. But it's really so much more than just decoding sounds and words. And for example, you can't secure food, shelter, or clothing very well without literacy skills, right? So you can imagine how communities are affected when their citizens struggle to read or write, use technology, speak English, engage with their children's schools or their healthcare providers or their supervisors at work.
Right, so we're talking about, a job application, a tax form, a school application, all these basics that we might take for granted that are suddenly huge obstacles for someone without those literacy skills.
Absolutely.
Well, can you tell us about literacy rates here in the state? Do we know where we are currently?
Well, literacy rates are difficult to pinpoint because literacy is often measured on a continuum, starting from below basic skills to basic literacy to intermediate and proficient. And literacy skills are different than, for instance, grade level attainment, which we often see on the census data. But the last state estimates for literacy rates were done in 2003 by the Center for Educational Statistics, and they estimated only the very lowest, the below basic level. And these are adults who have trouble with filling out a Social Security form, using a bus schedule, or understanding the total cost on a bill, for example. And in Wisconsin, that rate was about 7%, or we would say about 400,000 people of our population now. And if you add the second lowest literacy level attainment to that population, which is called just basic literacy, you would add over 1 million more people 16 years or older. So we often say that there are approximately 1.5 million people in our state of 5.7 million people total that would benefit from literacy services, and that's about 27% of our state's population.
And when you talk about things like literacy skills, what sorts of skills are we talking about that fall under that umbrella?
Well, literacy can be measured in so many ways. Our 77 member agencies, they offer a wide array of different literacy skills and education. So this would include one-to-one literacy tutoring or class instruction in adult basic ed, GED attainment, English language skills, citizenship classes, family literacy, health literacy, financial literacy, workplace, computer literacy, and literacy programs in county jails and our state's correctional institutions.
Talking to Michelle Erickson with Wisconsin Literacy, kicking off a series on Central Time and Wisconsin Life, looking at efforts to boost our literacy here in the state. And Michelle, when I think of literacy, I think of what you mentioned, that one-to-one instruction with volunteers. I've known people who volunteered as literacy tutors. And I understand a few months ago you started a statewide campaign to find more of them. So who are you looking for? Who do you want to sign up?
Well, anyone that has the ability to read and write and is patient and really that's wants to make connections with people in their community and give back. So, it doesn't require someone to be proficient in a foreign language of that learner to be able to teach someone English. It doesn't require you to have teaching skills to be a tutor of an adult basic ed student. So our programs all offer tutor training sessions before people are matched with adult learners.
I imagine that it's something that has the potential to change both people involved. There's the person who's learning to read, but it seems like a powerful connection to have between two people. What have you seen?
It truly is, and it can be very transformative. And I, from every student I have tutored in the past, I always felt that I receive more than I gave. And if you're working with someone from another culture, you learn just the tradition and all the cultural things that are a part of their everyday life that you might not have exposure to at any other time. In adult basic ed, I know my first student didn't know the names of the letters or the sounds that they made, and he was a welder, 39 years old, and was laid off from his job, and his 9-year-old son was having trouble reading in school already. But I just remember the rewards I felt when he was able to finally read the words on the television screen before the commercial had changed, and how excited those small little victories were as he gained more confidence and got his driver's license and just became more engaged in his community.
I wonder, Michelle, if someone's listening and saying, wow, that's me or that's a family member, what's the best way to reach out and find some help building those literacy skills?
Well, people seek help for all different kinds of literacy skills and to improve their quality of life. And so it's whether you need to improve your skills for a promotion at work or gain better computer skills or just improve your reading and writing, you can go to our website at wisconsinliteracy.org, and at the very top left corner is a link that says Find a Program. So all 77 local member agencies and all their contact information can be found there. So it's really easy to find help in your community or your county.
Michelle, as we begin to wrap up here, what are some of the obstacles that keep people from reaching out to you, from getting in the door, and what would you like them to know about why it's a good thing to do?
Well, I think part of the obstacles for people that are Americans and they are struggling with their reading and writing as adults is just the embarrassment and the shame that will come with that, you know, not having that decoding skill when so many other people have learned it at such an early age. And so I think that understanding that people, for various reasons and various, you know, of various capabilities, learn at different rates and have different life stories that bring them to where they are. And so that to get over that and understand that there's someone out there that is willing to work with you and prove your skills to get you to where you need to be, whether it's for work or helping your kids along in school or, you know, whatever the reason, learning English to communicate with your supervisor. There are many programs out there and many people that have been professionally trained to help.
Michelle, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Michelle Erickson, Executive Director at Wisconsin Literacy. We're continuing our week-long Wisconsin Life series focusing on literacy in Wisconsin. One aspect of literacy that doesn't get much coverage is health literacy. It doesn't matter how well you read English, anyone can have trouble following medical instructions and interpreting advice from healthcare professionals.
Dr. Paul Smith is with us to talk about health literacy here in Wisconsin. He's the medical advisor for Wisconsin Literacy, and he's a professor in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at UW-Madison. Dr. Smith, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me on.
So, in a nutshell, what do we mean when we say health literacy?
Well, health literacy is kind of a confusing phrase. You know, people hear the word literacy and they think about ability to read, which is what you've been hearing about a lot this week. But health literacy is really about people finding, understanding, and acting on health information.
And that could be in printed form, a medicine label, I suppose. But it's also, I guess, understanding what your healthcare professional is telling you, the instructions they're giving you.
Right. It could be text, like on a website or a document, or, of course, when you're talking to somebody. And be honest, a lot of healthcare is done back and forth verbally, you know, saying things and hearing things and that sort of thing.
And is the medical profession, the healthcare profession, starting to think we need to do more with health literacy because all the great ideas, the great advice in the world won't help if the people don't really come away understanding what it is?
Well, there's definitely an increased awareness. I mean, this was really a relatively new issue. Even 20 years ago, it was just beginning to be talked about. But nationally, locally, internationally, there's more and more awareness that it is a problem. There is issues with effective communication, whether it's text or verbally, and increasing efforts to try to do a better job at it and to learn more, research, things like that.
Let's visit the doctor's office now and talk about what kind of things in that interaction can be an obstacle for the patient. What kind of hurdles do we see in health literacy?
Well, there's a bunch of different things that can happen. I mean, often, to be honest, people are not very prepared when they walk through the door, so they may have concerns or questions or that sort of thing. But if they haven't written them down or thought about them very much ahead of time, they're going to have trouble communicating those to whoever's going to try to help them. And so, you know, that lack of preparedness starts things off on the wrong foot. And then once the interaction gets going a little bit better, there's this tendency because people who work in the healthcare industry, we learn all these words and acronyms and phrases that become second nature and pretty quickly forget that everybody else in the world doesn't know these words and phrases. And so we start talking in jargon that people don't understand. And the patients, and we're all patients, to be honest, at some point in time, we're ultimately all going to be a patient, tend to be afraid to ask questions. They don't want to look stupid or feel bad, or they may think the doctor's in a rush or whatever, and they just won't ask clarifying questions.
Well, let's tackle those problems before we move on to other potential hurdles. For that, the insider talk you mentioned, the jargon, what are healthcare professionals doing to try to make sure they're speaking a language that everyone else is speaking?
Well, some things that are happening, the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine Public Health is redesigning their curriculum, and just they've just been doing that over the last year. And I was on a committee that was working on that. And one of the things that they're going to be trying to change is teaching medical students as they go through school about effective verbal communication and written communication, so that from the very beginning they're more aware of the issue and trying to do a better job and watching out for the jargon and that sort of thing. I'm involved in educating residents who are doctors who've finished medical school and are learning how to be a family physician. And one of the things I talk about is you really need to have two vocabularies, one for your colleagues with all the jargon and words that we use all the time, and another one for your patients. And I tell them that if they could explain it like they were going to talk to their grandmother over the kitchen table, that probably patients are going to get it.
And on the patient side, you mentioned patients coming in not knowing what they want to ask, what kind of important information they should communicate. What do patients need to know when they go into the doctor's office?
Well, a lot of it is just knowing why you're there and what are the questions, what are the concerns, and to be honest, getting those on the table, getting them out at the very beginning of the visit. I mean, that's really the most important thing to understand. And then toward the end, to not leave unless you understand what's going on, whatever it is, whether it's preventive care or treatment for a problem or an illness or a chronic condition, something like that, what they're supposed to do about it, and why it's important to do those things. And so it's on them to say, hey, I didn't get it. You tried, but it didn't make sense to me. Try again. And to be honest, if doctors are busy and we're all in a rush at times, but if they're not getting an answer, they can ask, well, who else could I talk to? Could I talk to a nurse or someone else that could help me out with this so I can understand a little bit better?
One thing I wonder sometimes in the doctor's office is if I'm in there for thing A and there's some other data out there, and I don't know, a headache, but my left knee is numb. I don't know. Do you volunteer potentially irrelevant information? Is that overloading the doctor with unnecessary detail, or is it maybe a valuable clue?
There's a good question. Actually, what's really helpful, especially when there's a new problem, like a numb knee or whatever, a pain in your toe, is to be ready with tell the story about what happened. So when did it start? What did it feel like? How did it change over time? Did you try anything at home to try to make it better? Does anything that you do make it better or make it worse? So, and try to make that reasonably concise, and then let the doctor ask questions as time goes on. It's often people haven't even thought of, well, what really was it? How long ago was that? And those things often can be pretty important.
Talking to Dr. Paul Smith about health literacy here in Wisconsin. Now, a key part of this is that a patient who's in seeing a healthcare professional for a condition, a problem, comes away knowing what the doctor wants them to do. They know what their course of action is, how often to take the medication, what exercise to do, the dietary, whatever. How do we make sure that the patients come out of the office with that down? And should we be, in some cases, people bring a note taker, I know, for serious conditions.
Yeah, that's a common recommendation, especially for somebody who can't hear very well or older folks, especially. And to be honest, no matter how old you are, it's really hard to remember things when you're listening and talking and trying to process things and then try to remember all that stuff as well. So, and it's really hard to take notes yourself to do that. So to have someone else along is a great idea. Two sets of ears are always better than one set of ears when you're listening to things. The other thing is healthcare professionals that we can do, and this is more common with electronic health records now, is we can actually type out instructions, go over them with the patient, and then print that off and hand it to them so that they have this list in front of them to help remind them of some of the main topics and then the details about what was said about those different things.
And how about post-visit follow-up? Are people too shy, or do they not know where to go if they need that clarification? What was I supposed to do?
Yeah, that's also a really good question. Every doctor's office is a little bit different sometimes, but there's always somebody there that can answer follow-up questions. Sometimes on the way out, when people are leaving, they'll think of something and they could talk to the nurse or even ask the receptionist if there's somebody they could talk to, and usually there's a nurse or somebody that's available. But later on, when they call in, often people will say, gee, I need to talk to the doctor, but we're so busy, we can't be on the phone all the time with the patients. So again, there's almost always a nurse or somebody who will field questions, often can answer the easy questions, And if something needs the doctor's attention, then they can pass the question on to the doctor, get an answer, get back to the patient, and get the answer that they need. And one sort of word that sometimes hits right is called the triage. Triage is actually a military term for somebody who decides what's most important. But the triage nurse or the triage person fields the call and decides, you know, what to do with it. Is it urgent or not? And try to get answers and help people decide what to do next.
Another obvious obstacle, I guess, is this is often a stressful situation. Somebody comes in, they've got a problem, maybe a problem that's life-threatening in now or in the future. How can patients, how can healthcare professionals make sure that the important stuff gets through when the mind is occupied on a very serious thing?
Yeah, that's a really hard one because it's not something the patient can control, mm-hmm. you know, and you're absolutely right. You can be highly literate, very intelligent, know all kinds of things about medical stuff, and hear bad news. Oh, you have cancer. First mm-hmm. time people hear those words, everything just sort of shuts down. It's just noise. They're not really processing anything. Oh, I have cancer. All the stuff's going through their mind. But you could be sleep deprived. You could be stressed, as you mentioned. You could be in pain. You could be afraid. You know, all of those emotions interfere with the ability to understand and process and remember and all of those things. And that's not really something anybody can control. You could acknowledge, oh, gee, I'm in this situation, so I need some extra help to understand things. And then it's on the healthcare providers and the people that are providing the information to recognize that in folks and know that they're going to have to talk with them again later when they can process things better.
We're talking to Dr. Paul Smith with UW-Madison looking at health literacy. He's the medical advisor, by the way, at Wisconsin Literacy.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about health literacy? And what do you do to learn about your medical conditions and about the health system? And what resources do you go to? If you're a healthcare provider, how do you make sure patients are understanding what you're telling them? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation now with Dr. Paul Smith talking about health literacy.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. As a patient or maybe a family member of a patient or as a healthcare provider yourself, have you seen problems with communication, with making sure important health information is communicated in those visits? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Before we get to callers, Dr. Smith, we are talking about literacy all week and efforts to improve it here in Wisconsin. So around the state, what are we doing when it comes to boosting our health literacy?
Well, a lot of the work that's been done around Wisconsin over the last 13 years that I've been involved in it has been mostly awareness raising, just getting out in front of medical audiences and other health audiences just to tell people about this issue and start to encourage them to start to pay attention and do things about that. And the previous interview that you had with Michelle Erickson, I've been working with her and the folks in Wisconsin Literacy for quite a while, and we've been putting on conferences about health literacy starting 12 years ago was the first one, and we put our sixth one on this spring, and it's really grown to the point where this last one that we had over 300 people from 22 different states and three countries come to Wisconsin to learn about health literacy. So we were able to continue to raise awareness, spread what's been going on in Wisconsin so people can learn what's working and how to try to move forward on it. There's also, because of those efforts, there's a lot of organizations and people around the state of Wisconsin that are trying different things and trying to improve communication in hospitals and clinics. And there's been a variety of projects that I've been involved in. One of them is looking at the prescription label. You mentioned mm-hmm. that. And sometimes it is hard for people to understand that information. And there's some guidelines out there for how to make it easier to understand those. And we're working on a project to have some local pharmacies make those changes so that it will be a little easier for people to understand what they're reading on the prescription label.
Let's bring in a caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got Christine on the line in Eau Claire. Christine, hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I just spent the last week in January in the hospital as an advocate for my dad, who just turned 81. He had endovascular surgery, and the surgeon actually had discharged him. yet we were in the family waiting room talking with the discharge planner, saying he is not ready to be discharged. And it was a mess. He ended up having a stroke and had to go to the neurological floor. I just wonder how that happens, that one physician can say, yep, he's ready to rock and roll, and the nursing staff, I don't know how that works, how the communication works with the nursing staff and the physicians.
Christine, thanks a lot for the call, and I'm really sorry about that situation. Good luck to you and your family. But Dr. Smith, if a patient's in that situation, let's go on that communication side here, and they're hearing two different things maybe from healthcare professionals, how do they make sure they advocate and get something sorted?
Yeah, that's a really tough one, especially when you're hearing two different things from different clinicians or different a pharmacy and a physician, for example, who are not saying the same thing. It's that ask questions and be sure you understand. People need to raise the issue. I'm hearing this from one person. I'm hearing something else from the other person. What should I do? Can they two get together and sort of figure it out and, you know, somehow get back to us so that we know exactly what the thing, you know, what we should be doing? And the caller actually raises a really important issue. That's called a transition of care, when one goes from a hospital to home or hospital to a nursing home or something like that. And communication is especially difficult. And it's especially fraught with error. It's very common for things to not quite get done correctly in those kind of transitions. And again, there are organizations that are working hard to try to do a better job at it, but you know, things still happen.
You mentioned earlier technology being a boon in a way. You can really print off very specific information for a patient, for one thing. Is technology also helping that sort of handoff situation from one, say, one institution to another or one physician to another?
It can if it's done well. You know, one thinks that all the information from a particular health record, for example, is available to everybody, but in fact it's not. They're not interchangeable, and there's issues of confidentiality, so you have to be careful about who has access to the information and things like that. So I think technology more has the promise to really facilitate things, and sometimes it can work really well. Again, system is changing and trying to do a better job using the technology.
And staying with the health literacy and technology aspect, we have the internet now, and somebody might get a diagnosis or might have a symptom and look online and find things that are scary and unrelated, or they've got the right diagnosis and a really bizarre prescription. How is this part of health literacy, trying to sift and winnow, if you will, what's out there?
Absolutely. It happens all the time. People come in and say, oh, I looked up this, or I think I have that, or that sort of thing. And probably the most important thing is to know the source, to understand you can find anything that will say anything on the internet practically. And so you want to look for a reliable source, a national organization for a particular health issue or health problem, like the American Diabetes Association for diabetes questions or things like that, or a medical school or some other reliable source, rather than just, not paying attention to what that address is or what the organization is, where the information is coming from.
As we wrap up, if you had just one message for patients, which at some point, as you say, is all of us, when it comes to health literacy, what would you tell us?
Don't walk away when you do not understand. Ask questions, and if you're not getting answers, push harder until you get answers. And to be honest, if you're interacting with a particular provider and you're not getting answers out of them, think about another provider.
And a quick message for the providers.
Well, start paying attention, folks, if you're not already, because checking understanding, being sure people actually understand, especially about medication use, that's probably the most important thing, because so many bad things happen when people don't take medicines right, that we need to make sure we get that correct.
Dr. Smith, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Dr. Paul Smith. He's medical advisor for Wisconsin Literacy and a professor in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about health literacy in Wisconsin.
This interview is part of a week-long Wisconsin Life series focusing on literacy in Wisconsin. Tune in to Morning Edition at 6:30 and 8:30 a.m. and Central Time at 4:15 each day this week for more stories and interviews. You can also listen to archived segments at WPR.org by searching Wisconsin Literacy.